Okay, we're going to have to do our thing again, Dazza. What in the world is Blue Thunder?
I got you.
Well, you usually get me, to be fair. Is that Dana Carvey?
Yeah.
What in God's name is he doing on this show?
Okay, yeah. Blue Thunder was, it was actually a spin-off of a film with Roy Scheider, which is basically about a super police helicopter.
Super police basically. Helicopter.
Well, pretty much. It's sort of, it's the sort of helicopter, but basically the idea is that the helicopter, the police basically invented this, like, you know, this military style helicopter, which there's basically no way in the world that this, this helicopter would ever be allowed to be used by the police. And they did it, well, maybe now it will be. they basically did a spin-off TV series. And it was just like, you know, your weekly sort of A-team style sort of, standalone episodes where they basically went around basically solving crimes, blowing shit up and lots of flying with this super police helicopter, which seemed to have a Gatling gun on it as well.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
It's not standard police issue, I'm pretty sure. But yeah, it was. I mean, that theme music. You've got to admit that theme music just screams 80s.
A little bit. What doesn't scream 80s is Dana Carvey. I did not know he was a thing until the 90s. But
yeah, well, he's very young in this. If you look, he's. I think this is probably one of his first gigs that he got and everything. Also, so
there's no way this is after SNL or during SNL.
I don't know. I remember watching it as a kid. You know, it was just sort of like, you know, your typical sort of, you know, American fun TV show at the time.
All right,
kind of like a low budget Airwolf.
Yeah, that's a cool looking intro, and that's an awesome looking helicopter. If you haven't already, I'll probably just link the intro in the description. It's actually kind of cool, at least the helicopter anyway. I can't speak for the series, but the fact that you wanted to put it in the intro maybe speaks of the series.
I think it only lasted one season. It was when the film's pretty cool, though.
There you go.
Yeah, Blue Thunder, the film, that's pretty cool. Worth checking out.
All right, I'll be sure to check it out then. All right, that's... That's our intro talk. Let's not waste any more time, and let's talk the meat of today's show. Let's talk UFC 205.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those. I mean, this is. I think in some ways this has taken the place of UFC 200 as being the biggest show of the year, because for years UFC 200 we're talking about. I mean, they even sort of altered the. Alter the running order a little bit just so we could have UFC 200 being in Las Vegas in July. And then it's basically this, and then they got the clearance to run in New York, which has been the big obsession we've been wanting for years. And it was almost like an emotional feel to the show when we first started. When we opened, I thought the Goldberg and Rogan, I thought we were actually going to have tears in their eyes. You know, they seemed so moved by the fact that they were in New York and in Madison Square Garden and everything. And, you know, it was a really great card. They brought out, you know, tons of celebs to be at ringside and everything. It's one of these things that, and UFC, I know this from personal experience of going to UFC shows, that the atmosphere you feel in the building is never replicated on TV. I think, you know, pro wrestling and like WWE, and I think, and in some ways boxing as well, I think they do a better job of conveying the atmosphere, and, you know, whether it's the mics or whatever they use, it just sort of, you know, it doesn't sort of come over on television at times. And, you know, to me, this as great as the show was, the great lineup and everything, I thought, particularly as we got on later, that the crowd, it always seemed quiet. You know, it just sort of, and I think the, as we get into later, I think, you know, Weidman losing took the local boy, took the wings out of the wind out of the sails slightly. I think, you know, on paper, the main card that we're going to talk about, you know, one of the most stacked we've had in a long time.
Yes. The thing is, the prelims were also equally stacked, but with the way weight cutting is now in 2016, that saw many casualties as far as the undercard was concerned. So, I mean, obviously, we're not going to here discuss it. We may talk about the results, but we're not going to go into detail about that. But we are going to go. We got lucky enough that our main card was not a victim of a weight cutting.
No.
All right. Let's start with our opening bout, Dazza.
Yeah. I mean the first bout on the main card was quite a sad one. Afterwards, it was Rachel Pennington. Beating Misha Tate by decision. Mm-hmm. And Pennington, I think, she's one of those, I think she's one of the most underrated, women that they've got on the roster. Mm-hmm. You know, she has a really good record. I don't think she's been stopped while she's been UFC. She's lost a few fights, but they've basically been by decision. But the last time she lost was to Holly Holm and in a really close fight. I mean, to be honest, I personally could have seen it, going for Pennington in that fight, mm-hmm. Because it was like, really, really close. So, so she could have easily walked away with victory there. She's got a good little run going at the moment. And yeah, she looked, really good, really, pretty much dominated, Misha, sort of outpoint of the decision was never really sort of,
in
question of anything. But afterwards, and probably not really surprising for how long she's been, fighting Misha, announced her retirement pretty much straight away. And really, really sad. I mean, it's sort of, she's had a really great career. One of the sort of the pioneers of sort of, women's MMA, because I think she's, looking back, she's been a really, really important person, within the women's MMA movement, because although Ronda obviously is the big star and she's basically, the dominant fighter, and she basically is, whenever, there's no question that she's, a far superior fighter to Misha Tate. I think Misha Tate still played, a real big part. For one thing, there was the big rivalry with Ronda Rousey. Now, without that rivalry, if you look at all the other fights that Ronda had, she's a great fighter, but her fights aren't necessarily, they're more of an occasion because most of them are such blowouts. Mm-hmm. Most of them basically take place in, ending the first round and everything. So, she's wonderful to watch for just how dominant she is. With Misha, you get really great fights. I mean, some of the best fights in the UFC for women, she's been involved in. I mean, the fight she had with Kat Zingano is still one of my all time favorite fights. Even though she lost that one, it was a really great fight. Misha had a really great fight with Julie Kedzie back in Strikeforce a long time ago, and she also, the two fights that she had with Ronda, she really gave Ronda, a handful, even though she didn't. She was beaten, by armbar and everything. She basically, put up in the second fight, she basically went to about third round, which at the time, I don't think anyone had actually gone any sort of distance with Ronda. But the first fight as well, the one in Strikeforce, even though it ended in the first round, that's a really good little tussle. I mean, there was sort of some back and forth, she sort of, she tagged Ronda a few times, didn't really have her in trouble, but she made a fight of it. And she, in that fight as well, she's basically pretty much broke her arm because she sort of like, refused to tap until, the last. I'm not even sure she actually did tap. I think the referee stopped it. But, but she showed loads of guts in it. And that dynamic that those two had, that sort of rivalry, I think it really brought the women's division up to be not just for Ronda Show, but to basically having like, a grudge fight. It basically, that sort of, the grudge element of that really sort of took it, but this was like, this wasn't just, a gimmick of women fighting, but, but there was sort of excitement to be had in there as well. And I think, it was so great as well that she basically got the world title before she retired.
Yeah.
To me, one of the big, a big upsets, but one of the most dramatic fights ever, because she was basically, losing the fight on all the cards and everything. She looked like she was just going to, go to a decision, and she just managed to pull out that sort of, win from basically, virtually nothing. And when she got that, I've never seen a fighter get a choke in and just pull it back with so much determination. It was just probably one of my favorite moments in MMA. But yeah, so, a really sad, but, quite quite good that she basically managed to do it on like such a big show and such a big stage, and also about the sort of that story as well, because she mentored Pennington on the Ultimate Fighter season. She was in her coach, so it was almost kind of like the little story there of the sort of the student and teacher and sort of like, passing the torch type of thing. So really good opener.
Yeah, and you don't believe any of the stories surrounding her retirement?
What stories are those?
Now, obviously, this is all hearsay and rumors, but supposedly she's having some problems in her personal life. And that's what a lot of people think. What's going into consideration when she was considering retiring?
Right. Okay. I'll be honest. I've not heard any of that, but you know.
Well, yeah. That's what the rumor is. Obviously, there's no actual basis on this, but that's what the rumor is as of right now. It's supposedly there's something going on with Caraway, and that helped judge her decision. I mean, obviously she's fought for 10 years. She's won both women's titles in Strikeforce and UFC. So obviously she's done everything, but at the same time, you kind of wonder, cause this retirement's kind of seemed to come out of nowhere. Obviously she's on a two fight lose streak, so that can't be good. And especially the way that the fight went, there were times where she was in the fight, but for the most part, the fight didn't seem to go her way. So maybe she was just frustrated that night, or maybe it's something she may take back. But it's one of those things that you mentioned earlier. It's maybe just her winning the title was the way she wanted to cap her career off, and she's perfectly content just living out the rest of her life, just not doing anything else in MMA, because she's done it all. She's won world titles, she's had big fights, she's had come from behind victories. She's done it all. So you have to imagine she's pretty content, but at the same time, it seems kind of odd. It just kind of came out of nowhere. So who's to say? Obviously, we've seen retirements in MMA before, so who's to say she won't take this back? She's still, I believe, 30, so she's still, time is definitely on her side for a comeback. So I think you have to take this on its face value that she's going to retire and not come back, but it would not surprise me in the least bit if she decided to come back.
Yeah, I mean, it could be like a spur of the moment thing. The thing is, I think she's lost two together, and in both fights, she basically did not look like the old Misha. In the one in July, she was basically just totally wiped out, and she looked really despondent after that. And then to have a fight here, where she was basically, went the distance, but was basically, like you say, never in it, and just sort of was basically sort of, taken to town. She may think that she's just got to a stage where, it's basically gone past her now, but she's past her best and everything. And she may come back, but you think, how long would she actually be to get anywhere sort of, a decent sort of like, career going now? Cause she'd be a long way from ever being put into consideration for another title shot or even like a big fight with Ronda or anything like that. So, yeah. We'll see. I mean, how many people have we seen in the past sort of, retire and then sort of like, be back. I mean, Randy Couture did the whole speech where he said, these are my gloves, these are the last fight time you'll ever see me in the fight. And then a few months later, was back fighting for the world title. So I know what you're saying, but, we'll sort of, we'll see.
My main consideration is, obviously, the thing with Caraway is obviously just a rumor. But when you look at the facts, it's like she's 30, and yeah, she's done everything that you can in this industry, at least at that weight. And She obviously, she's been in the fight game for 10 years, but at the same time, she's 30 years old, and I'm sure there's plenty of things she can do, but I think she's still got a couple more years of fighting left in her. And at the very least, she could still fight Cyborg, or she could possibly move to different weight divisions. There's still plenty for her to do. I think this was sort of a last minute thing. I can't imagine she's given this a lot of thought, and I think when time goes on, she'll reconsider it and maybe consider coming back, because she's still in the prime of her life, prime of her career. I can't imagine her just retiring, just going off into the sunset, just on those two losses. There's plenty of big fights left for her, and there's plenty of money to be made. So I have to imagine at some point she's going to come back, or she's going to do something. I think this isn't the last you've seen of Misha Tate. I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay, we'll see.
All right. Moving on to our second fight, Yoel Romero versus Chris Weidman.
Oh, well, this was a crowd killer. I mean, you had the you had the all American local boy out there, and basically Romero, who's basically sort of said a few dodgy things in the past that sort of have got people's ire, and it was a decent enough tussle for a while, and then all of a sudden he just pulled out this like weird sort of fine knee that just sort of caught Weidman, knocked him. I mean, knocked him senseless. I mean, the fight should have been stopped real, earlier than it should, because he was out. And it was scarily out. And then he sort of, there was blood pouring from him and everything. And then Romero afterwards, the weird stuff was after the fight where he basically.
Oh, that was awesome.
Did this like weird, like militaristic march and strut and salute. I didn't know
I've seen someone explain it. It makes sense. What's his nickname, Dazza? Soldier of God.
Oh, yeah, Soldier of God, yeah.
But obviously, when I was watching it live with a bunch of buddies, obviously he's of Cuban nationality, so we just assumed he was saluting to Castro. But no, I think he was just doing the Soldier of God gimmick, which is, I mean, you can understand, considering he's a very religious man. We obviously seen promos where he's been skeptical of what people have done, or at least the way certain votes have gone. But I thought it was a wacky promo. I love the translator. I love the Michael Bisping hanging on the balcony when he was doing the commentary. That was awesome. I think they should do that for every single fight. Just have the champion looking at there like a Shao Kahn from Mortal Kombat 2 or something, and they're just looking on and judging. They should have every single world champion, if there's a title eliminator going on, especially a big one, just have the world champion there to just look down upon them.
Yeah. Well, one person, actually, I've got to say this as well, one person in the audience who was really enjoyed this was Madonna. She was cheering and everything. She seemed to love him, which basically means that, Madonna hates America. That's all I can take from this.
Well, that shouldn't surprise me, considering what she's still rocking the English accent. I mean, it's been a while since anyone's cared about Madonna, so I wouldn't know off the top of my head. But last time I checked, she was still doing the English accent. So she's maybe since long stopped caring about America. No, I just think she just liked the fight. I just like she liked the knockout.
Yeah. Or maybe she was sort of, she just saw all the big muscles and everything, and just sort of, which, let's see if this fight doesn't get no contested.
What do you mean?
Just besides Romero, it would surprise me.
It wouldn't shock me if he failed this fight too. That should actually be worst case scenario. He goes out there and beats Weidman in New York because they wanted him because he was, he's from the area. UFC wanted to use him as a big poster child for the New York market, and for him to go out there and lose and then have Romero go out there and test positive. I mean, I'm sure Jacare will appreciate it, considering he's out in the cold now, considering that Luke Rockhold went out to injury. Remember that? That was like the thing was, whoever had the most impressive victory would have been Luke Rockhold or Jacare or Yoel Romero or Chris Weidman.
Yeah.
That went the way of the dodo when Luke Rockhold got hurt. By the way, that was hilarious. Did you see that headline when people were being critical of AKA and he was quick to defend them because it's like, well, we don't have problems with injuries. It's not a problem at AKA. And then immediately has to bow out due to an injury for UFC 205. That was hilarious.
I think basically most fighters should basically just shut up at times, because any time they sort of say anything, it basically, there's some sort of like god of irony that covers MMA. And they basically just sort of, whenever somebody says something, like somebody saying that they're sort of, you've never failed a steroid test or anything like that, or anyone says, this card's great and it's great, we've not lost any fights yet, somebody comes along and basically just sort of goes bow.
Yeah, this was a fight we always knew was going to happen one day, when you just consider how the pedigree of both these guys. I always thought it would have been a championship scenario, considering how dominant of a champion Chris Weidman was. I did not see the Luke Rockhold loss coming, so obviously I just assumed this fight was going to happen, but in the main event of a pay-per-view for a championship bout. Obviously, we knew these two were headed for each other, but you thought with Yoel Romero's silver medal in freestyle wrestling, you thought this would be at least more competitive, if not to UL's benefit. But especially in the opening minutes of the fight, the first round, just Chris Weidman took him down at will. And it's like, obviously we've seen what world-class wrestling does in the Octagon, but still, you have to imagine that he would have done a little bit better, would have been a lot more competitive as far as the takedown was concerned. Obviously, I thought if anyone could have stopped Weidman's takedown, it would have been Romero, but, I mean, obviously later on in the fight, I think when we were going into the second round that you had Yoel Romero eventually be able to take down Chris Weidman, which, you know, that's the biggest compliment unto itself, but the fact that he was just taken down so easily in the first round of this fight was just, it was, honestly, if it wasn't for the knockout, this fight kind of looked like a blowout, because Chris Weidman was just easily schooling him in the stand-up, he was taking him down at will. So this is one of those scenarios where Yoel Romero lucked into the knockout, and I have to imagine if you're Michael Bisping, you saw the way he handled Yoel, so I can't imagine, obviously, you're Bisping, so obviously you're not a world beater, so you're a little worried, but this isn't the scenario that we all thought, where Bisping would be sweating bullets, he'd be worried, he'd be the paper champ that some people might think he is, but I don't know, and this, I think when they eventually meet up, I think Bisping has got a good chance of being this guy.
Possibly. Well, we'll see. I mean, if I was to bet on him, I'd bet on Romero. He just sort of, because I think he seemed to be, although you're right about the first round of that, he seemed to be coming, you know, starting to find his, his rhythm with the wrestling and everything. He seemed to be coming back into it when, that's how it looked to me. And I mean, I'm no expert or anything, but that's how it sort of looked to me. But we'll see. We'll see.
And he did his gimmick again where he sat on the stool for way too long, even after the allotted 30 seconds or minute was up. It's like, oh, I have to imagine if you're Bisping, that's the one thing you got to talk to the athletic commission. He's like, as soon as that bell rings, you have to make sure he gets off his stool.
Yeah.
For someone who's a soldier of God, he's kind of a crooked guy.
Yeah. He's a soldier of God and cheese.
But yeah, like I said, the promo was awesome. Bisping doing the double bird, the thumbs down. That was awesome. And Yoel Romero calling him out. I think that's going to make a fantastic commercial. And I'm just waiting for the promos. I'm just waiting for the press conference to help hype up that fight. That's going to be fun.
Oh, yeah. I mean, any time that Bisping basically is sort of like, you know, building up a fight, he's as good as Conor, but he's certainly in his league. You know, for building, and basically anyone who's sort of like, you know, he manages to get this sort of this thing about him. He's just so like, you know, gets people to sort of hate him so much. You know, virtually every fight he goes in, he manages to find something to hate the other guy and turn it into a grudge match. And it was funny because Romero sort of almost doing this sort of like, you know, I love you sort of thing. You know, I like you and everything. It's just, you know, so yeah, it's one of these things that I can see there's going to be, you know, a lot of, I think this could be actually one of the weirdest builds to a fight.
UL's kind of a charisma, but it's a weird kind of charisma, especially with the translator. It's like, okay, this guy is, he's kind of funny. Like, obviously, English is obviously not his first language, but at the same time, he's kind of a bit of a charisma to him. He does these interviews that, you know, they're kind of funny because he obviously doesn't speak the language, or at least it's not his first language. But still, he at least gets it. He knows how to trash talk. He knows how to call out a guy. So, you know, I'm eagerly anticipating the back and forth promos between the two.
I have to say, he needs to take that. I don't know if his translator is actually with Romero. That translator is the best translator I've ever seen in UFC. Because normally the translators are just there and we just basically say whatever they've been given, you know, quite impassively and everything. This guy actually put some personality into it. He managed to make it sound like, you know, but he also sounded like a showbiz fighter when he was delivering the lines.
Yeah, he wasn't just translating exactly what he said. He was translating the way he was saying it too, and that was impressive.
Yeah, and that, you know, to me, he needs to be basically, you know, he needs to go with him, you know, because he, you know, that's, yeah, you know, that
he needs
guy
to be
good.
His manager, is what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh God, his suit, and then the man bun, even though he had thinning hair on his temple. God, yeah, this guy. I just want to know what goes through his head.
He's a great double act.
What's that? Yes, very much so.
It could be like Kali and what was it? What was Kali's guy?
He's had several over the years. I think he had, at some point he had Daivari, and then he had the one Indian writer from WWE. I don't know his name, but he's had several managers over the years.
He's the guy I was thinking of, you know.
Yeah, I don't know the name of the guy, though.
Okay.
All right, moving on to our triple main event, starting with Dessa. Are you bold enough to try to pronounce both ladies' last names?
Well, it's Jen Chaycheck.
Okay, and then Carolina Cool.
Carolina Kowalski.
I think it's Kowalski. Okay, I don't know how to pronounce it, but I'm pretty sure that's how you pronounce it. Let's just call it Carolina for ease of our listeners, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, this is I have to say that Joanna Jędrzejczyk, she's one of those. She's probably the most fighter that I am most uncomfortable watching, because she's so. There's just some, the way she takes apart her opponents, it's just something, it's scary. You know, she's so, she's basically scary herself in the demeanor and everything and the way she bullies her opponents and just the intensity she brings. But when she's basically sort of, you know, her striking and everything, there's just something that's really unsettling. I can't put my finger on it, but it's just the way she's so clinically takes them apart, and so, you know, so just basically breaks people down. She's just so one of the most intimidating fighters there is to watch, and we saw it again here. I mean, she was, you know, for the most part, Carolina wasn't in the fight. She was just basically being picked at will, and the girl was tough. I mean, the shots she was taking, you know, and the impression she kept coming back for more. But what I found fascinating was, it's one of these things that they were Rogan and Goldberg were talking how big of a mismatch this was proving out to be. And how it was basically, you know, Carolina was doing nothing. And as the fight's going on, I'm thinking, I won't be surprised. And this is just me with Bryce Wood to write love and irony and everything, is if at some point Carolina is basically just going to tag and knock out Joanna. Mm-hmm. And that didn't quite happen. But she caught her in that fourth round with this shot. And she, if you look at it in slow motion, Joanna was on basically Dream Street.
Yeah.
You know, for a few seconds, she said that she wasn't sort of like knocked out or anything. She was, but you look at where her eyes go and where her body goes and everything. She was out on her feet.
Well, to be fair, if I can play the devil's advocate for a little bit, she did have her nose broken. So maybe she was just more so, I guess, in awe, or she wasn't expecting her nose to be broken so quickly. She's never had that experience. Although the fact that she's a professional fighter, she's been doing this for years, not just in mixed martial arts, but she's been a kickboxer for years. Maybe just threw her for a loop. But yeah, I'm sort of there with you. She did look like she was on wobbly legs, and really had Carolina. And I'm not quarterbacking. I'm not the armchair quarterbacking here. Obviously, I couldn't have done any better. But, you know, you have to imagine, had things gone differently, had she swarmed her differently, she might have been the new 125 world champion.
Yeah, I mean, just another shot that she could have taken her, possibly. You don't know. But, yeah, it really sort of, like, you know, made for, from that point on, it made for, like, a really dramatic fight. Up to that point, it had been, like, just this, you know, amazing display of striking. And from that point on, it was like, she's tagged her. You know, she can hurt her. You know, this can, we could see, you know, be seeing something here, and it sort of, you know, it made it into, like, you know, for me, a really, really exciting fight. And you know, so but yeah, Jen Chaytek, she's got the problem is, and they alluded to this on the commentary, is that she, you know, she's such a great fighter, but she's got no one to really test her. You look at it, but I love the strawweight division. Don't get me wrong, but there's so many, you know, really exciting fighters to watch. You know, I love watching fighters like Paige VanZant, Michelle Waterson, Tisha Torres. You know, even sort of, you know, down the list, there's somebody like Felice Herring. But they put on really entertaining fights. I mean, one of the reasons why I think they actually did the Ultimate Fighter and actually created the weight division is over in Invicta. They had all these girls who were basically putting on just these, you know, these really great fights, and also had these personalities and look about them, but just sort of, like, you know, it was an exciting division. I love the division, but it's like everyone's like fighting for second place. You know, there's no, you've just got this one champion who is just basically streets ahead of anyone, and you just can't. I think at this stage, the only person who's basically going to beat her is her. if she slips into, like, say, an Anderson Silva type mentality, where she basically starts almost getting sort of bored with the contenders, and almost sort of, like, you know, finding that she has to sort of entertain herself by sort of showing how dominant she is in every fight, and basically sort of almost sort of, like, you know, sort of, you know, like Anderson Silva did, where he's sort of mocking his opponents and fooling around. I don't think she'd sort of do that, but you could, you know, there's a chance that she could basically, you know, maybe take people either lightly or just sort of get into a stage where she's almost, I don't know what I'm saying here. She basically she's just sort of that good that I think at this point the only person who's going to beat it is her. She's actually loses concentration, you know, herself. Because I can't see, you know, if you look at all the list of all the fighters, I mean, the number one contender is Claudia Gadela, and she's basically, you know, she's beaten her twice. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, but she, and, you know, there's no weight division to, you know, to go up into. You know, there's nothing between strawweight and bantamweight or anything, you know, so, but, she's just an amazing fighter to watch.
Yeah, eventually at some point you're going to have to book the freak show fights, obviously people who are not deserving of a title shot, because at some point she's already cleaned out all the credible contenders. At some point you're going to have to book her. I mean, obviously Rose is a fantastic fighter, and eventually she probably would have got a shot one day. But I get the feeling you're just going to have to do that title just out of necessity, because she's literally just gone through all the worthy contenders, and I think eventually she's going to have to make her way to the Rose Nakayumas of the world, and eventually I know it's going to be a blowout, but I have to imagine it'll probably do pretty well if she ever fights Paige VanZant. I know it's on its surface it's a freak show fight, but really there's nobody left for her to fight, and if you want,
and she's popular and she's a name, so she, you know, she. There would be, like, you know, a story, and sort of, like, you know, I can see it being one of these where people would, you know, they'd be tuning in to see if, you know, if, you know, lovely little Paige could beat the, you know, the unstoppable warrior. There is, like, a straight story there, even though the results might not be that pretty.
Yeah, exactly. And she's young enough to where you could do the first fight, and if she loses, it's no big loss. You could always have the ace of eventually she, you know, as she gets older and presumably better, but at the same time, I can't imagine she's ever going to be Joanne, but you can always have that in your back pocket. It's like, oh, well, the reason why she lost because she was so young. Give her a couple more years and, she may be able to give Joanne a run for her money when you know full well she probably won't. But it's one of those things where she's literally cleaned out all the credible contenders, and eventually she's got to fight people because they have to put on shows. I mean, they definitely are a business, and they need to put on fights that people want to see. And I can't imagine them eventually not putting on that fight. Dazza, what do you think of the fight? I mean, obviously, I'm not going to say I'm one of these people who are critical of Joanne. It just, after seeing that one Carla Esparza fight, how she can be so dominant and just, you know, have these spectacular fights, I've not been impressed with all of her championship bouts. She's obviously not a very, I wouldn't say, she's very technical, but a lot of her strikes don't have that power behind it, and she tends to put on these 5-round clinics. And I'm sure if you were a fighter and you watch for the technique, but as someone who's just a casual observer, you watch these 5-round fights, and obviously they're not, I wouldn't say they're boring, but at the same time, they're not exactly setting my world on fire. So I don't know how I feel about Joanne.
I personally like watching her, because, you know, she's sort of, she's clinical, but she you know, she's sort of relentless. She, you know, she, there's not sort of, like, you know, she's constantly, you know, working and looking for the, you know, striking, as opposed to another fight that we'll talk about, you know, shortly. But, you know, to me, she's all action. She's not all sort of, like, you know, flying in there with everything to as being a knockout punch, but she does basically just, you know, tear through people. You know, gradually. You know, I mean, I was there at the Gadela fight, the second one, and it was in the last two rounds. It was getting to be a stage where it was almost uncomfortable to watch because she was just, like, you know, tearing. Even though the shots weren't like knockout shots, there was sort of, each one was sort of enough and stinging enough and constant enough that it was basically sort of, like, you know, brutal to watch. She's got this thing that even though they're not straight knockout shots, just they're so accurate and sort of, you know, and strike him, but she just sort of, you know, to me, I think she is, you know, one of the most, you know, the more devastating, you know, relentless fighters there is to watch, you know, and I sort of, you know, and for me, sort of, you know, personalities always, you know, always add to, you know, to my excitement of a fight, you know, and just the way she is, because she just has this sort of, you know, thing about it, but she actually sort of enjoys, you know, and wants to hurt her opponent. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just how it sort of comes across to me. So I personally find her fascinating to watch.
I mean, obviously she's got the personality thing. I think I love her Jekyll Hyde persona. Obviously when she's doing media, she's obviously the friendly girl from Poland who obviously English isn't her first language, but you know, it's charming. It's very reminiscent of Machida, where she obviously isn't super fluent in the language, but she speaks enough to get by, and the fact that she doesn't speak the language exactly perfectly gives her a certain kind of charm, but at the same time it's a nice persona, what you'd want from a champion in UFC, especially from a woman. And then she's able to just flip a switch and turn on to just beast mode, where she absolutely looks terrifying. She's someone who, even though I'm here a man, if I saw Joanne with the mean mugs that she makes, I'd be horrified and terrified, especially what I've seen her do in the octagon as well. But you know, it's one of these things to where obviously the Carla Esparza knockout she has on her highlight reel, but I get the feeling it she's not doing herself any favors as far as being the big star. Obviously she's the only other woman champion in the UFC. But at the same time, she hasn't had those emphatic, dominant knockout victories. So, if anything, I feel like that's the only thing holding her back. She I would say, other than that, she's a complete package. She can talk. She has the persona. She has the aura of invincibility. When you feel like you're watching her fight, especially in this one, the idea that opponents have any chance, it's like, you know, even when she was able to get Joanne wobbly, it's like you felt like you were watching, I don't know, like an eclipse or something you would have never expected to see. You knew eventually that someday it was going to happen, but you weren't expecting it when it happened. But I get the feeling she's on the cusp of being a really, really big star. But I just eventually I think she's got to address the fact that she's not having these spectacular knockouts. I mean, obviously these are just nitpicks. She obviously is just looking to continue to retain her title and you know, be the best that she can be, but I have to imagine eventually she probably wouldn't mind having some spectacular knockouts as well. And maybe when she does fight the Rose Nakayumezes and the Paige VanZants of the world, she'll eventually get those knockouts.
Yeah, I think the thing is though, even though she's not getting the knockouts, every decision that she takes, she looks like she's torn apart her opponent. Mm. You know, she even though they've lasted the distance, they've taken a real battering. It's not like if somebody's like, if she's not, it's not as if she's like beating opponents just by, you know, just scoring and not doing any damage. She's hurting these people, but they're lasting the distance, but it just means they're getting a bigger beating than what, when they've been knocked out quite, you know, so to me, It's not as if you're just watching like a sparring session, which you started to get with Anderson Silva in some of his title defenses. Mm. You know, you are, she is basically, you know, a killer in that case. You know, she's sort of, after the fight, they look like they've been battered.
Yeah, but even Anderson Silva had those spectacular knockout victories that really put him on the map. I mean, God bless Joanne. She's a dominant champion. I can't imagine her, you know, aside from her fight on Saturday, she's never really been in trouble. But I think that's the final piece to her puzzle as far as being the big star that she was hoping to be.
Yeah.
All right. So, speaking of fighters who go out there and they win on points and they're not that spectacular, it doesn't look like they're going for the knockout shots, let's talk our co-main event. Tyron Woodley defends his 170 title against Stephen Wonderboy Thompson.
Yeah, I seem to be alone in this, in the fact that, for the most part, this fight bored the hell out of me.
No, you're totally, yeah. you're 100% correct. I know there's people that are willing to forgive and probably weren't paying attention for the first couple of rounds. But yeah, this, aside from the rounds where Tyrone was dominant, it's kind of a snoozer of a fight.
Yeah. I mean, for a world title fight as well, you know, it's not like telling people how they should fight or anything like that. But when you're in a world title fight, you kind of just want a bit of somebody, you know, really fighting for it and going to war. And I didn't really get that from this fight. It just felt, you know, this is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about strikers. It looks more like a sparring session. I know and a lot of people have sort of said to me that they thought this fight was great and that they love the sort of, you know, the tension and everything. And this whole thing about it being like a chess match of striking, to me, I was just like, I'd be sat there just, you know, for about a minute or so thinking, throw a punch. They just seem to cancel each other out. I mean, don't get me wrong, the fourth round was awesome. And, you know, when he sort of like, you know, because Thompson looked like he was gone. You know, he got knocked down. He almost looked like he was out. And then Woodley got on this choke that he seemed to be in for ages. And it was clinched in so tight that you thought he's basically going to go out soon. But then you start to think, if he doesn't stop him, he's going to be in trouble because he's going to have gassed himself so much. And then Thompson managed to get his head out and actually started taking the fight to Woodley and was basically battering on the ground. And I was thinking, this is, you know, if the next round had a built on that, I thought this next round is going to be great. I thought Thompson's going to come out, he's going to try and basically sort of press the advantage and, you know, and get Woodley, and it's going to be like a real dramatic thing. And you didn't get that. Again, it was more of the same of them just sort of like, you know, circling each other and just sort of looking to try and get that shot in. And for the most part, it just bored me. It's the sort of striking that I just don't find entertaining at all. I know technically it's probably great. You know, if you're sort of somebody who really knows your business, you'd probably be fascinated by this. But for a world title fight, I kind of want, you know, I want action. And, you know, and I want somebody, it looks like, you know, I didn't, when I was watching in the final round, I didn't get the sense that it was sort of, that there was any urgency in Thompson. It was sort of like, you know, this is where I'm going to take the title or anything. I just didn't get that sense. and I just found it sort of, you know, really disappointing. The most entertaining stuff for me happened after the fight.
Oh, yeah, especially with the announcement. Obviously, we knew something was up when we had not seen Bruce Buffer. I mean, yeah, Bruce, was it?
Well, it went into the crowd. It went in to talk to some, like, officials or something.
Well, even before that, it was a while before we saw him make his way with the decision. Obviously, he was there talking to the judges. He made his way to the octagon, and he looked at his scorecard, and he went back to talk to the judges. And obviously, his role is just to read what's ever on the card, but even he knew something was up. He looked at that card, and it's like, that doesn't make any sense. How does that decision make any sense? So obviously, he argued with him to a degree, but obviously, he had to announce it the way it was on the card. And obviously, I'm sure for the people who were uninitiated, they probably just thought he screwed up. I remember I was watching with a couple of friends. I'm like, oh, this is Bruce Buffer's Steve Harvey moment where he just completely messes the announcement. But he did his job correctly. He read what was on his card, but unfortunately, it made him look like a goof.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously wasn't his fault because he basically went to get clarification. So he was basically telling, he basically announced him what they told him. But as soon as he announced that, you know, and I'm no expert, but I'm thinking, this isn't right. You know, this can't be, basically, if, you know, just so what we're talking about, on two scored judges, it was a 47-47 draw, and then the other judge gave it to Tyron Woodley. But Buffer basically, you know, and again, because what he'd been told, he announced Woodley as being the winner. When basically it wasn't, it was, you know, because most of the two judges had gone for a draw, that's what the majority decision was. So it was a draw. And Joe Rogan was sort of, he looked sort of like a bit bemused. And because I remember on The Ultimate Fighter, this happened, you know, a few years ago where they had a majority draw and everything. And it was just sort of, it was just funny because eventually they had to basically call, you know, Jogan back halfway through his interview and that. And Rogan's basically saying, you know, because the crowd start booing, and Rogan saying, it's the same score. It's just the, you know, the decision that's different, you know. Because at the end of the day, Woodley still, either way, retains his title, you know. So, but the other thing I thought would have been interesting with this is, supposing my other judge, because it was a close fight, supposing my other judge had gone for Thompson instead of Woodley. And then you would have had Bruce Buffer announcing a new champion. because as it stands, it doesn't make any difference if Woodley have a draw or Woodley won. You know, the title's not changing hand. It's still a Woodley, championship, coming out as the champion. But if they'd have screwed up and, at that moment pronounced Thompson as the champion and then had to go and take the title off him, it would have been like.
I love the way when they did, there was a clarification that needed to be made. The way that Tyron Woodley just clung onto his belt, he's like, oh, no, you're not taking my belt.
Yeah.
That would suck. Especially with Tyron Woodley, the way he is, sometimes he's very defensive, and it's like, he's not one to shy away from playing the race card, and that would have just given him so much ammunition if something like that happened. Obviously, I'm reminded of what was the flyweight fight decision where the judges had done the math wrong and they added it up incorrectly and we had a bad decision? Are you familiar? Do you remember that when they were doing the brackets for the first flyweight champion?
I remember it. I can't remember actually who was the.
The participants, yeah, but
but
that was awesome. I was hoping we were going to get that kind of situation, but I'll admit I didn't know how the situation worked when I heard the three judges' decision. I just assumed that's how it goes. I just thought because the two judges cancel each other out that the prevailing judge, the fact that he gave the one fighter the decision, I thought that would have been what would have made the difference. But no, it's done by my majority, and obviously it was a majority draw, but obviously the New York Commission's kind of new to this. This is their first fight, so I think this is a bit of a hiccup. This was a bit of a result of them being new to the MMA thing.
Yeah. But yeah, the only thing coming out of this is that we might get a rematch. So, I'll be perfectly honest. I know a lot of people, because somebody I know actually said that he could watch this fight every other month. He enjoyed it so much. But I really don't want to see these guys in there again.
Well, I'm not here defending them, this Stephen Thompson's style. But you have to take into consideration his background, his karate background. Obviously, how many of those Machida fights were absolute stinkers until we finally got the knockout? Or if we got the knockout, obviously he's very defensive. He's very elusive. He's not one to want to take a hit, and when he does take a hit, he's very reserved when that happens. So that's something you have to take in consideration. His fighting style is just not going to lend itself to being spectacular or very entertaining. Which on paper, people should have saw this coming.
Oh yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not calling him for the way he fights because, that works. That's how his style is. And that's his job is basically not to entertain me. His job is basically, to win the fights. I'm just saying as a fan, I personally don't particularly, want to see that fight again. But like I say, I understand that his job is basically to win the fights. It's just that I just don't particularly find that particularly style entertaining. By the way, I think the fight you were talking about was Demetrius Johnson and Ian McCall.
Yes. Oh God, that was so sad. And here's the thing: because they did that wrong, they had to do it again.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that was hilarious back in the day.
Yeah, apparently it was to do with bad handwriting and maths. That would probably happen to me if I was a judge. Because I have bad maths and I also have absolutely shocking handwriting. So if I was a judge, I would probably be I'll probably be causing chaos myself.
But it's just funny. Obviously, I'm not picking on you, Dazza, but I thought this was very similar to the women's fight where it was obviously just a technical showcase, but at the same time, it put me to sleep. I felt the same way about the women's fight. I'm like, I know this is entertaining in theory because of the technical showcase I'm probably watching, but man, am I bored. Obviously, you had that first decisive round in with the Tyron taking him down and beating him up, and then you had that exciting fourth round where Tyron nearly finished him. I'm sure he regrets now in hindsight 2020, him going for the choke, because I'm sure he just kept pounding on him. He probably would have got the fight waved off and he would have defended his title. But it's really hard to not book a rematch here because just the way the way the judging went, and the fact that obviously some people, and I have to imagine a majority of people want to see a rematch when it's perceived in their mind as a spectacular fight. And as long as those people thought it was, you know, a great fight, those are probably the people that are going to buy a pay-per-view. I mean, obviously, I hate the fact that we're going to get that fight, but at the same time, it's like, well, Damian Maia is not exactly an exciting fighter either. So I think we have a lose-lose scenario as far as an exciting fight. But yeah, we're probably going to get that rematch, and then Damian Maia is probably just going to have to wait for his title shot. I'm not one of these people that think GSP or Conor's going to get the next title shot. I think it's just going to be Damian Maia just going to have to wait out, and we're going to get this rematch. But like I said, spectacular fourth round. This fourth round was tons of fun, but I can't justify it. That can't justify the four rounds that were just kind of boring, bit of a snooze fest.
Yeah. If a fifth round had been different, if a fifth round had basically built on from the one before, I think it would have been I would have loved it as a fight. But, you know, it would have been such a fight. You know, there's nothing like having a fifth world title round where you've basically got, like, you know, the champion on the back foot and the other one really pressing and giving everything. And, you know, but that didn't happen. You know, it just was sort of more, it was again more of the same, more of sort of like, you know, stalking, looking for, there was no sort of urgency or any sort of like anything like that. So, yeah, so it wasn't a fight that I was particularly thrilled with.
Yeah, perception is reality. If people perceive this as an exciting fight, then when the second fight comes around, they're going to be excited for it. Even though if you probably go back and watch it, the same people, and watch it for the four other rounds, they probably thought it was a bit of a snoozer. But the fact, I even heard a couple of my coworkers, they were like, oh yeah, that fight was spectacular. I thought Tyrone deserved to win. And I'm like, okay, you probably weren't paying attention or probably talking during the first three rounds. So I'm willing to forgive them. But at the same time, I'm sure if they sat down and watched this fight in its entirety from bell to bell and couldn't do anything else but watch this fight, they'd probably be bored. But, yeah, I mean, oh God. Like, I will say this of the fight. I thought Tyrone was a bit of a paper champion. Obviously, Robbie Lawler had gone through those wars, and I'm sure those took its toll on him. So the fact that he went out there and just knocked him out as fast as he did, I was like, well, you were just in the right place, right time. Obviously, eventually, Robbie Lawler's age and the fact that he'd been in all those wars were eventually going to take his toll on him. So I just assumed he was just in the right place, right time. And I'm sure Wonderboy Thompson was just going to dispatch him very easily. Because, I mean, obviously, I talked to my buddy here, and it's what did he do to deserve a title shot? Beat Kevin Gastelum, and it's like, okay. And up until then, it's like, what? You know, you look at his record, and he's not a great fighter. He obviously, I remember Dana up until this point, he was saying Mr. Woodley here was a serial choke artist, but. You know, he proved to me that he can fight on the big stage and at least show that he deserves to be a champion. I don't know how long he'll hold the title, but he is certainly worthy of that 170 title.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that moves on to our main event, Conor McGregor challenging Eddie Alvarez for his lightweight title.
Oh, I mean, this was incredible. It was I personally thought Alvarez was going to be too much for Conor. And it was just Conor just made him look ordinary.
I thought at the very least it would have been competitive.
Yeah. And the thing is, from the moment he hit him, and you know, the first, I mean, it was basically pretty much not almost. It was hurting him with every blow he did, and just like, you know, everyone which was significant seemed to be knocking him down. But the first knockdown, you look at Alvarez, and he just had this look on his face as if to say, "What have I got myself into here?" Well, you know, there was one bit when he was sort of like was on his back, and he just looked. I mean, I'm not saying he was scared, but he just the look on his face was just like it was just like complete shock. As if he did not, you know, had no idea, you know, what he could do next. It was just a complete, one-sided, demolition. And again, it was just from the start, when we were first knocked down, you just thought that you were just seeing something just like absolutely, incredible. You know, you keep, I think, people have thought that, you know, because he lost to Diaz, that was him exposed. And, you know, and that was pretty much going to be Conor Dunn then. It was like, you know, we've seen him do some good stuff, but now reality is going to set in. And he seems to have basically, you know, the loss to Diaz seems to have made him, you know, since then even better. It shows his sort of, you know, to me it shows his, like, you know, his real work ethic. That he basically sort of, like, you know, he jumped back in there and he basically, you know, beat the guy who beat him, and then he's gone up a weight class and he's basically, you know, won another belt. It just seems to be getting better and better. There was a time when people thought it was just like a flash in the pan. It was basically a decent fighter who had, you know, a big mouth and everything. But he's growing into his role, as a world class champion. And there's not been anything like him before in the actual in the personality stakes and the sort of, you know, and the promos and everything. But you also get to a stage. I mean, to hold two titles at two weights. It's just, you know, this thing could run. You know, we're going to see what happens next with the belts, you know, because UFC seems to be saying, you know, that he can only defend one belt. Conor says he's basically going to have belts, and he wants more. He wants to go up another stage and everything. And this is going to be some, you know, one hell of a, a hell of a ride.
Yeah, obviously there was those naysayers, and they probably could have made an argument. Obviously, ever since he came back from his injury, he had Dennis Seaver, which was kind of a fight that really benefited him. It was a bad matchup. Obviously, UFC booked that fight with the idea of making him look spectacular. He had the Chad Mendes victory, which people were suspect of because Chad Mendes only had a couple of weeks notice before fighting. The Jose Aldo fight went so shortly, people didn't know what to make of it. And yet, like you said, when people saw that first Nate Diaz fight, people thought that was Conor McGregor being exposed. And even though he went back and won, it was still kind of questionable because I wouldn't say he barely eked out his decision, but, you know, that was a pretty close fight going into that final round. And, you know, there were still questions on whether or not this guy was legit. Obviously, this one, some you could have made it a very good argument that he was just in the right place, right time. And in this fight, he really showed what he was really made of. He went out there and just absolutely schooled Eddie Alvarez. You could say whatever you want about Alvarez. Obviously, he's not the best fighter. You know, obviously, he was the champion, but, you know, you could make an argument that maybe he also, like Conor, was in the right place, right time. But he just went out there and just didn't even look competitive with McGregor, and he absolutely schooled him. He looked like he was pawing him with jabs, and they were just devastating him. He just went down, and it's like you look at those punches, and then they look very hard, but just the way it would just rattle Alvarez, it was just one of these things that you just watch and you're just in awe of it, because, you know, it's one of these guys who very rarely do you see. The talk match, what happens in the ring. Even, I mean, obviously, we've seen some fighters who've had some ability to talk, and they can back it up to a degree, but we've never seen it like this. This is like Chael Sonnen and Anderson Silva's body. It's like, you know, you have the both parts of the super fighter, and it's like, you know, you can't imagine anyone giving him a run for his money. I mean, I can't imagine where you go from here. I have to imagine, Yusei said they're going to strip him of the belt, but, you know, they need high marquee fights, and the idea they have Conor McGregor as champion in two divisions. I don't think they'll do it, but I think there's that temptation of letting him have the two belts and letting him defend the two belts in the different weight divisions. I think eventually he's going to vacate the 145 title just because the weight cut, I have to imagine, is not easy on him. At the same time, it's where I think all the big fights are at 155. Obviously, you could do the rematch with Diaz, which I have to imagine that's probably the direction they're going to want to go, because you have the trilogy, and then you can do it for the title as well. You obviously have Cowboy Cerrone up there. Khabib, to a degree, has very much like Yoel Romero. He has a certain kind of charisma. He has a certain kind of comedy to him, where I have to imagine that's probably going to be a big fight to a degree. And then the fights he could do at 145, it's just I don't see it unless you want to see him against Faber, but Faber's retiring, and obviously he wouldn't garner a title shot, but if he were to vacate the 145 division, he could probably do that fight, maybe fight BJ Penn in a bit of a dream fight. But I think cooler heads are going to prevail, and I think they're just going to he's going to drop the 145 strap because it's like, it doesn't really benefit him in any way. Obviously, some people want to see the rematch with Aldo, and I'm not one of these people that want to see it. I can't imagine that fight going any differently than this Alvarez fight where it just, you know, he has that reach and he has that power. And I have to imagine a rematch is probably going to go more or less the same. Obviously, may last a little bit longer than a couple of seconds, but same time, I can't imagine that fight going the distance. I just, you know, for the foreseeable future, I can't see anybody, maybe with the exception of a Khabib, giving this guy a run for his money. And even that, if I know you didn't watch the fight, but man, Khabib, guy who's fantastic on the ground, he can take down just about anybody. But, you know, he's a guy that really needs to work on his stand-up because he did not look impressive in his bout against Michael Johnson here. And just the way he was able to school Eddie Alvarez, obviously, you know, you don't want to completely count out Khabib, just considering how spectacular he is, and you look at his record. But if UFC were to put on that fight right now, I'd probably go with Conor being the favorite, even though it sort of defies logic. It's just after this fight, it's like how can you pick against the guy?
I have a question.
Sure.
What was the promo like afterwards? The reason I ask this, and you're not going to believe this. BT Sports, who basically show UFC in the UK, they basically blanked out most of Conor's interview because he was swearing. Mm. Yeah. I mean, it was because at first, what they did is they basically, you could hear like the crowd, but you couldn't hear Conor. Because at first I thought, oh, but of all the times the microphone's going. And, you know, because it basically say something and then it would cut and then about 10 seconds later, it would go back on. Every time he swore, they basically cut the entire feed. But it's just the most ridiculous thing because if, look at it this way, people who tune into UFC, they're basically tuning in to a sport where basically people beat the living daylights out of each other. Well, you'll see people knocked out. You're basically watching violence. And the idea that they actually have a sort of like they have a banner coming up, saying them, we apologize to anyone who may be offended by the language used in that interview. And it's like I've come in, I've tuned in to watch violence. Do you think I'm really bothered about sort of hearing the F word or whatever?
I want to talk to the person who was offended. He saw I was looking for my barbaric violence, and I was offended because the one man said a swear word.
Yeah, I mean it's just the most ridiculous. But they do it every time. I mean, normally they just put up the banner saying apologizing for the any language, and the commentators will chime in and that. But it's like to cut the whole thing out, and it's like. This is like 5 a.m. and stuff. It's not as if sort of like, it's like in, 8 o'clock, prime time viewing when people are doing, might sort of stumble across this. This is sort of, a violent sport, and the idea that basically people in this day and age would basically be, offended by the bad language and stuff. So I'll have to track it down on YouTube at some point, but I basically only caught little bits of it. The only bits I caught was, where's my belt? Bring me my belt.
Yeah, that was
the only thing I caught.
That was the first half of it. He was basically complaining, right. And I said it. I kind of knew it, especially when Conor made his way to the ring. He didn't have his belt. And it's like, what do you want a belt? These guys don't have the second belt. And it's like, that's what you want. That's the photo op. You had to know there's a 50-50 chance Conor was going to win. And if that was going to happen, you wanted the photo op of him with both championships. Because that's what you were paying for. That was the history-making moment in this fight. And the fact that they weren't prepared with the two belts. Now, obviously, I think the blame falls on both of them. It's like Conor should have known better to have his belt in advance. But at the same time, UFC also should have planned it out in advance as well. I think they both thought the other were gonna we're going to plan it. And it's kind of made sense. He wasn't out there winning a championship, so UFC wasn't going to go out there and make him a new belt, even though he didn't win a title. He didn't defend the title. He just went out there and won another title. So I can understand from UFC point of view. But at the same time, from Conor, he's imagining. He even said in his promo, he's like, this is a $4 billion company, and they can't make another belt, even though he didn't defend it. Or, yeah, in fact, you know what? I have the promo right here. Do you want me to play it for you, Dazza, or should I just skip it?
I'll catch it later.
Okay, but the first half of his promo consisted mainly of that, and then he just talked about the fact that he deserves to be making more money. He wants some equity in the company, and it's like, okay, I don't see him getting that. I can see UFC try. I can see him. Honestly, I don't think he's going to get equity. And obviously, I've since listened to Dave Meltzer of the Observer Radio. It's like you can't have every fighter who gets some notoriety, some pay-per-view power behind them, and you can't just be giving them equity in the company. I don't know if he's smart enough to just use that as a negotiation tactic or that's what he legitimately wants. I mean, obviously, he has tons of leverage considering the company needs money. And at the same time, he's the champion of two divisions, something that's never been done before. But at the same time, he may just be using it as a negotiation tactic. But, yeah, that was really the second half of his promo. It wasn't really – you know, you've heard Conor McGregor post-fight promos, and they're pretty spectacular. They're pretty funny. I think this was the latter. It was just like – okay, it was just out there, and it was just whatever. He really was complaining about his belt, and then he's talking about the fact that he wants money. And I know he was teasing on doing an announcement. And we had a bit of an announcement at the post-fight press conference. Obviously, he's going to be a father. I know there were rumors that he was thinking about taking 2017 off. He may take a good chunk of it off, or he may be using it as a negotiation tactic. I don't know. But, yeah, it wasn't much of an interview. And even in the post-fight press conference, you obviously seen Conor McGregor. Even after a fight, he tends to be his usual charismatic, bigger-than-life self. But this is the first time, I think, after the fight, he seemed very calm. He seemed very down-to-earth. This is probably the Conor McGregor you get when the cameras turn off. And, you know, he's done what nobody else done, so there's nothing literally left to promote. The persona doesn't need to... Obviously, what I think when he starts doing the build-up to a fight, but I think... You know, for the foreseeable future, we're going to see a different Conor McGregor going forward.
Okay.
But that was UFC 205. Obviously, we didn't get the dream card because of the two preliminary fights that were taken off the card. But still, you had, I mean, obviously, you had a bit of a fairly decent undercard. Frankie Edgar versus Jeremy Stephens, Khabib Nurmagomedov versus Michael Johnson, Jim Miller versus Thiago Alves. I mean, it was a great card, but it wasn't the once in a lifetime super card that we were hoping to get. But the main card delivered. Nobody got injured. Nobody had to pull out because of weight cutting. But for the most part, I give this a solid thumbs up. It wasn't what I was hoping it'd be, but all things considered, it was pretty good.
Okay.
All right, that's the news portion of the show. Let's go into our regular portion of the show where we do rate and slate. Obviously, last year we did 1997, so we are doing 1998. These are from TKO170.com. These are the top 10 performing films of 1998, starting at number 10, Lethal Weapon 4. Number 9, Shakespeare in Love. Number 8, Dr. Dolittle. Number 7, Mulan. Number 6, Deep Impact. Number 5, A Bug's Life. Number 4, There's Something About Mary. Number 3, Godzilla. Number 2, Saving Private Ryan. And at number 1, Armageddon. Dazza, what is your rate of all of these top 10 films?
My rate on for 1998 would be the number 2 film for the year, Saving Private Ryan. Mm. And I think it's that opening is one of the most intense scenes I've ever seen in a film. You know, the D-Day landing that they have. It's just so absolutely brutal and soul-destroying. And it really... This is the thing where... it's the sort of war movie, but in a lot of films, when you get, like, a big battle brewing, it's a cause for excitement. you know, it's of course because you're going to see a great real action film. And because of that opening scene where basically the violence is so, you know, just so, you know, horrific, there's just like one intense, horrible scene after another. Because of that, that basically really sets the tone for the rest of the film. So when you come to the final big battle at the end and you hear the tanks coming and everything, you're almost actually dreading it. You know, at least that's for me, you know, you're almost wanting to sort of, you know, the battle not to happen. It's just like, you know, it really sort of terrifies you. I mean, there's a scene in that sort of, in that opening. And it's an amazing scene because, the Americans and the Allies come across as bad as the Germans in it. You know, both sides are basically sort of, you know, causing, you know, atrocities. They'll be using the flamethrowers on the Germans, and then sort of, you know, you hear a medic shouting, you know, let him burn. And, you know, you see sort of like, you know, surrendering Germans being shot. It doesn't hold back on the fact that basically, you know, there was evil on both sides during the brutality. And there's one scene that always sort of, you know, strikes me in that film. And there's one moment which is like, there's like some humor in, where a guy gets shot in the helmet, and he like shoots his helmet off, and he looks at the helmet and he's got a hole in. And then Tom Hanks says to him, you know, you lucky bastard. And then the split second later, the guy gets hit again in the head and killed. And it's like that. There's one bit of levity in the scene, and immediately within a second, they take it away. It's just such an amazing, an amazing film. And just throughout it, it's just, you know, it's just a, you know, incredible film. You really get into, you know, the quest of Slave Ryan. There is a bit of schmaltz in there. But you know, the story, I think, is based on, like, not true, not the story, but it's true. But it's based on there was a family of brothers who were all killed in one of the wars. And after that, they always made sure of basically keeping, you know, whenever families went to war, keeping at least one sibling sort of out of the actual reaction, so to speak, so you didn't get an entire generation of a family wiped out. So there is some sort of, you know, the fact that they went to war, you know, all the length space, you know, just to save one man. It's, you know, there is kind of sort of, you know, a bit of a precedent set there. But I just think the film's like, you know, just an incredibly moving, you know, film, and just sort of just a really brutal depiction of war.
Daz, are you sitting down?
Have I seen what?
Are you sitting down?
I'm sitting down. Go on.
You're gonna get mad.
Go on.
I have not seen Saving Private Ryan. Hey, to be fair, as far as atrocities that have been done on this podcast, you don't like Rocky IV, and I still find a way to look at you in the eye, Daz.
Okay.
So forgive me here. Yeah, I know I've not exercised my slate before. And really, since the 90s started, I was like, wow. It's really like Sophie's Choice trying to pick a top film here, because, you know, you just had spectacular film. I think this is the first year where obviously some of these films, I wouldn't say are necessarily bad. I mean, some of them are, but not all of them. There's enough here where if you had to twist my arm for me to pick a rate, I'm sure you could. But since I've exercised in the past me not picking a slate, I'm going to go with not picking one here. Obviously, some of these films I like. Dean Pimpak, A Bug's Life, Mulan, to a degree, Dr. Doolittle. But, you know, I can't sit here and say, well, this film stands above the rest, and I'm going to go with it with my rate. So I'm going to choose to abstain.
Yeah, it is slim pickings, I have to say, because if it was of Saving Private Ryan, I would have had to settle for Deep Impact, which is fine. I enjoy it as a movie, but it's not. It would be basically just picking something for picking something. It's not the most inspiring list that we've gone across.
Oh, at least as far as a rate is concerned. When slate's concerned, oh man.
Okay. Well, I've got my slate.
Can't go wrong. Okay, what's yours?
Okay, my slate is basically the number one film, Armageddon.
Ooh, nice.
I just think this is a really stupid film. I think the thing is, this comes across, I know not, I would like to think that this film was written by someone who was a drilling enthusiast and loved people who worked on it and was basically somebody who collected volumes all about drilling. And he thought, I'm going to write a script where a meteor's going to hit the Earth and no one can save them. You know, the astronauts can't save the Earth. Everyone's, and it falls down to a group of drillers to save the day. And he's just, oh God, just the idea. I mean, somebody actually mentions this in the film, says, wouldn't it be easier just to teach astronauts how to drill than it would drillers to become astronauts? It's just the whole thing. I mean, you even get a segment towards the end of a film where they're actually, it's almost like a Rocky montage, but with drilling. You know, where they're sort of like, you know, they're sort of, you know, passing the drills from each other and sort of, you know, drilling and getting further into an asteroid and everything. And the bit where sort of Bruce Willis is trying to convince the guy, I think, I don't know if it's at gunpoint or anything, but he's basically trying to convince the guy not to set this bomb off because he said something like, you know, I've been drilling all my life. I know how to drill and I can drill this thing. Let's drill into, you know, and it's just, oh God. I just think it's just an absolutely lousy film, you know. And but the one saving grace about it is the absolutely awesome Aerosmith song. there's another scene as well where this guy goes to, he's basically sort of a father who's basically estranged. He's never like met his kid. His wife's basically broken up with him and she don't want him to have anything to do with the family. And the father tries to come see the, you know, the mum and the kid, and the little kid goes, who's that? And the mum says it's the TV repairman or something. Ooh. You know, go back inside. And then it shows you later all the astronauts getting on into the space shuttle and it's all live on TV. And the little kid goes, Mummy, the TV repairman's on TV. And the mother sort of sits next to him. She goes, that's not the TV repairman. That's your daddy. And it's like, oh, God. I think I actually started laughing in the cinema at that scene. It just was so sort of smoky and preposterous, but I think this is a absolutely awful film. argue this one with me.
You certainly would not get an argument from me. I think at least as I'm concerned, the one I'm going to go with, obviously Armageddon, great pick. I can respect it, Dazza. Good on you. I'm going to have to go with. The 500-pound gorilla in the room. Obviously, pun not intended, considering my pick. But Godzilla, the 1998 rendition of Godzilla, the American Godzilla. Man, this was just a spectacular flop. Just on all levels. Like, obviously, for our younger listeners, you didn't experience the promotional hype that surrounded this movie. This thing was like the second coming of Christ, the way it was promoted. You just saw ad after ad after ad, promotional tie-in. And obviously Godzilla, so you're excited, and this is the first time we're going to get to see him done by an American studio, and you think it's going to be this spectacular movie, and you watch it, and it's a complete flop. Like, it's absolutely terrible. There's no point at film, at this point, is this film ever redeeming? Just everything, this film makes every wrong decision at every possible moment. Like, first of all, a majority of the film, Godzilla's not even the film. They very quickly dispose of Godzilla. And already you know, when you see that, you're in for a bad, bad time. And then the design of Godzilla. It's like, you didn't have to, I mean, there's several things you could have gone back and forth with, the idea of the decision, with the script, the director, the producer, the look of Godzilla. That was a no-brainer. You just make him a giant lizard like he is in all the other movies. And you can focus on other things. But the decision they decided to go with is just like he had this elongated neck and he walked around like a T-Rex. And maybe they were hoping to piggyback off the success of something like a Jurassic Park. But just, you know, you look at this film and it's just an absolute dumpster fire. And there's nothing redeemable about this film. All the performances are terrible. Just everything behind this film is just an absolute complete flop. And the fact that it even made its way on this list as one of the top performing films. I thought this was a box office flop. I think they spent a lot of money on this film, and I don't know what they spent on this film, at least not in front of me right now, but I can't imagine they were too happy with what they got.
Well, they never made another. So to tell you a lot there, well, that it was sort of one of the box office, well, you know, took one of the biggest things at the box office and they never made another one. So, but the thing, I mean, you talk about the actual, the look of the monster. It just shows you sort of like, audiences, sort of filmmakers, you know, of sort of, you know, the '90s and to some extent today, they just created, they went for more menace. They obviously looked at the old Godzilla things, you know, but, you know, and for that's too hokey. We need to take this into like, you know, the almost the 21st century, and we need to basically make it look more fearsome and everything. And what we ended up with was something that basically just had no charm to it. But that's something that you need, you know, you need to understand when you make films. You need to have, you know, when you've got something beloved as Godzilla, you need to sort of have something with a bit of charm and some sort of personality. And when you start to make it more alien looking, which is what they did, you sort of lose being able to sort of relate to it in any way. You know, it would be, you know, there's a reason why one of the sort of the big, you know, most successful giant monster creations is King Kong. Because, you know, there's so much you can do with King Kong. He's fearsome and everything, but you can basically, you know, you can relate to the fact that he's a gorilla. You can, you know, there's almost like a human side to it. This thing, it was just like, you know, a big, massive sort of lizard. And you talk about the promotional campaign. I remember the very first promotional trailer, teaser, whatever, was brilliant. Because what they did is it was basically just after Jurassic Park. So that you have basically these school kids in a museum, and they're looking at a skeleton of a T-Rex, and they're sort of going, you know, the teacher's basically sort of telling them, you know, how fast it was, how it was the biggest predator of all time and everything. And then right at the end of it, a big lizard foot smashes through the ceiling and just crushes it. And it's just, and it was like, you know, just, and then, you know, and make, as a teaser, it's great because it's basically, it's almost declaring war on what was, you know, one of the biggest films of all time, you know, up to that point. But then what they came up with afterwards was just a complete and utter rubbish.
Yeah, maybe they were hoping with the promotion and the fact that it's Godzilla, they felt like, okay, we don't need to spend any more money on the film. Let's just spend all the money on the promotion. It's like, well, you certainly fool enough people to where this is number three on the top 10 on 1998, but really, oof. I'm sure they wish that the film had performed better, because really, when you're taking shots at Jurassic Park, you're hoping it was at least do as successful as Jurassic Park, but the fact that it just seemed like a blowout. Let's see. I'm looking at this list.
The budget was 130 million, and they got 379 million. I don't know if that budget's. I mean, sort of, it did business. It did money for its time and everything, but it wasn't a. The thing is, as well, I imagine this sort of like, you know, was sort of like really badly received in Japan and everything. The funny thing is, years later, the Japanese makers of Godzilla, they actually bought the rights to the American Godzilla creature, so that they could basically have the real Godzilla beat it in a match, in a fight, in one of their films. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, I saw that. That's awesome. Yeah. That's spectacular. I love it.
But what they did is they changed the name. They changed it from Godzilla to Zilla because because they'd taken the God out of it. Just Zilla. But yeah, they sort of, and they actually use CGI as, you know, because most of the Godzilla films are obviously like guys in suits. They actually went to the lengths to actually make this creature CGI just so they could mock the fact that it was CGI. It's almost like pro wrestling pettiness on one level, but at the same time, it's just, it's kind of a cathartic, basically, you know, so to just their way of basically just like, you know, absolutely taking, you know, something they hated in the American version and basically just totally destroying it, which I think is absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, I've seen that. That's hilarious. I love it.
Yeah. And it's also, it's not even like a competitive fight. It's basically lasts about like 30 seconds. It's brilliant.
Oh yeah. That was their commentary on the American Godzilla, as you would say, Zilla. But
Zilla, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, eventually Americans would get a second chance at doing a Godzilla film. And yeah, it was a little bit better. But I still think – have you seen the new Godzilla, Dazza?
I really like the new Godzilla film. Huh. I know it seems to it divides opinion. I personally really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people seem to hate the fact that early on you sort of see Godzilla for the first time and it teases the first fight, and then you sort of don't see it. You're seeing it on TV screen. But to me, it just built it so that by the time you got to the end, you were ready for the big fight. So I personally really like the new one.
Okay. I haven't seen it myself, just because the one thing I hate about Godzilla films, obviously this is one of these things that I always had kind of a casual interest in the kaijus, and I think after a while when I seemed my interest in comic books seemed to kind of wane, I was like, well, maybe this is going to be my new hobby. I'm going to get into kaiju films. And everybody I talk to, it's like, the fights are kind of fun, but really when you're talking about films, they're not really all that great.
I've seen a lot of them. They used to show them on Channel 4 in the UK. They had a season of them. And a lot of them, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. The fights are fun. But the plots to actually get there, because we always have to have sort of like a human plot and everything. The plots to get there, I found I would basically fast forward to and basically just get to the end. But the fights themselves are great. They're just so hokey and fun, especially when he's like, and they're funny to watch because each one gets more and more ridiculous and more campy. Because he starts off like the first one, the black and white one, is great. I really, that's one spray. But as they go on, each one becomes more and more ridiculous. And just sort of, and you get to a stage where after the title, basically, I just having Godzilla fight one guy, you start having tag matches where you basically have Godzilla and an ally against two villains, mm-hmm. So it just gets, but the fights themselves are fun. I mean, I will never forget the image of Godzilla winning a fight and then doing a Highland jig. It's just one of the most amazing scenes ever. But the kind of some of the later ones are good to watch as a full film. But there's a lot of the ones in between which have very weird plots. But personally, but they're worth checking out.
Yeah, the people always kind of shy me away. Expect, Would you recommend? I mean, obviously we're probably going to go into more detail because this is just me asking about monster films. But I'll probably do this off air. But just very quickly, is there a starting point, or would you just recommend the first Godzilla and just go from there? Or
if you look for particular eras, because what happened is they did the first Godzilla film, which is great, and then the ones after that started to get like a bit more cartoony, and then they basically pretty much did a reboot where they went back to like the original premise, which was basically that Godzilla was basically so I think it was 1984 that they did the reboot. So I personally would sort of, I'd sample some of the ones in between and then sort of watch the black and white one and then watch the ones from 1984 onwards. Because they basically are sort of they're a bit more serious, and the films are a bit more the films are better basically. Okay. So I would go for that. But some of the for campiness, some of the ones in between are worth sort of if you see them on the internet or anything, just having to fast forward through to the certain scenes with the monsters and forget the human stuff. But from 1984, if you want some good movies, I would start with 1984 and basically go from there.
Okay. Obviously, looking at TKO170.com, we do the new gimmick where I look through the rest of the – obviously, they have the top 50 films here. And I'm not seeing nothing really that reaches out to me. I'm looking at this.
The Truman Show's really good.
Yeah.
I really like The Truman Show.
Blade.
One on here I really like, and it seems to basically just because I think it's a fun movie, is Man in the Iron Mask.
Okay.
The Three Musketeers one, the one with Leonardo DiCaprio, and that one I really enjoyed. I really enjoy that one.
you can tell the 90s are very quickly ending, because I'm looking at this list. I'm like, Yeah, it wasn't like earlier episodes where like, oh man, that's a fantastic list. Oh, that's a fantastic movie. Oh, that's a fantastic movie. I wish we'd do top 15. It's like, no, I'm looking at the rest of the year and I'm looking at 1999. It's like, well, I'm glad we decided to stick with the top 10 films because after a while.
This is actually looking at it, this is a crap year for films. But this is the top 50 because I'm just going working through the there's a lot of really bad films on here. I mean, stuff like Lost in Space was awful. The Wedding Singer.
There's people that enjoy that film, but it's not my cup of tea.
Yeah, I mean, Star Trek. I can sort of look at, I can pick out the ones that I actually like, and there's not many of them. Star Trek Insurrection, I really liked. I thought that was a good Star Trek film. Like I said, Man in the Iron Mask. The X-Files film was okay. That one was sort of it sort of did the right thing in basically taking the TV show and then doing using a big premise so they could use the big special effects at the end sort of thing. I like that one. There's not a lot of good stuff on here. Meet Joe Black, I think, is quite nice. I think I quite like that as a film. But there's not much that I would sort of. This was a bad year.
you won't get any argument from me here, Dazza.
Yeah.
All right. Since we did that, we got that out of the way. We talked our best films, what we thought was considered. It was kind of a crap year, so I'm curious to see what walks away with Best Picture in 1999. Obviously, they do the year after. Daz, any picks? What won Best Picture? I know off the top of my head.
I actually know this.
Oh, okay.
Basically because I know this because it's such a to me it's one of those sort of really baffling ones where you look back on and think, really, that won an Oscar? And it's Shakespeare in Love, I believe.
Yep, you are correct, yeah. Sir.
And again, that's an okay film. You know, watching it as a film, I sort of, you know, it's you know, a fun film, but it's not one that you watch and look back on and think Oscar. You know what I mean? I guess you've got the list there. What else was nominated that year? I'm guessing Saving Private Ryan was nominated.
Sorry, I was getting a little ahead of myself. Let's see what also was also Best Picture nominations. Let's see. Sorry, just one moment. Yeah, it's one of these films you go back and look, and it's like you sort of scratch your head there. It's like, okay, I don't know why. Maybe this is the first year where it seemed like we saw the inner workings of the God, look at these. Okay, now I'm getting mad because I'm looking at this list now. Obviously, right. Elizabeth, Shakespeare in Love, Life is Beautiful, The Thin Red Line. And guess what else was nominated for Best Picture and didn't win? Even though I still haven't seen the film, but I've seen aspects of it, and I know it's a fantastic film. Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
What the hell? I can't believe I'm passionate about a film I haven't seen in its entirety.
I'm guessing, have you seen Life is Beautiful?
No, I'm not.
Wow. That film is amazing.
In a bad way, I have to imagine?
No, in a good way. It's a fabulous film, and it's the most unlikely film. But it's also heartbreaking at the same time. It's basically I forgot what country made it. It's a foreign film, and it's basically about a guy and his son who are sent to they're basically Jews in the Second World War, and they're sent to a concentration camp. But to basically sort of protect his son, he tries to convince his son that they're basically this is actually all a big game. Oof. And that they're actually basically. In a competition to win a tank and that everything that's going on. So he's sort of, you know, so he's saying, oh, we've got to wear these pajamas and everything and stuff like this. And we'll get so many points. And it's his way of basically protecting his son from the horrors of it and everything. And it's just, it's amazing to think that this is actually a heartwarming film about the Holocaust, but it is, it's just absolutely, you know, and but it's at the same time, it's also horrifying because you know what's really going on. And it's just sort of so heartwarming that he's managing to basically save, you know, to basically protect his child in this way. It's a difficult film to watch in some respects, but it is, you know, it is a fabulous film. I mean, to be honest, for actual creativity and for basically daring, you know, this really should have probably won. I would probably have said this over Saving Private Ryan.
Well, easily you probably could have picked it over Shakespeare in Love.
Well, yeah, definitely. I don't know if I'm... I think the actor for that won Best Actor. Because I remember he did a thing where when he went to sort of... He won some sort of Oscar because he basically did a thing where instead of like walking down the aisle, he climbed over everybody's seats. He basically sort of stood on the seats and walked along the seats all the way down to collect his Oscar. I'm pretty sure that he did it for this.
Yes, he won best actor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, that is an amazing film. But it basically, you'd have to be a really cold, callous person not to be moved by it, in my opinion.
Okay, I'll be sure to check it out then. So what? One of these?
Bring tissues.
Oh, gee. Maybe not then. All right, we talked the best of the best. Let's talk the worst of the worst. The 19th annual Golden Razzies. We've been through every single one. It's funny, we started the 1970s, we managed to hit every single Razzies. All right, let's go over the nominations. Obviously, you know the way that it works, Daz. I list off the nominees, and you try to pick off what won Worst Picture. Obviously, this is a weird thing. I'm looking at this list right now right off the bat. Didn't we have Spice World last year?
We talked about it last year.
It's made its way to the I know I didn't screw up.
It could be that it was released in the Europe first 1 year. And then was like released in America, because I've noticed that with a few films sometimes that the American and the British years are different. I've seen a few years like that, so it could be that we got it first because they wanted to punish us, and then you got it. And it was like, if we had to sit through it, the Americans and sit through it as well, then we sent it over there.
Okay, as long as we're punishing the Americans, Godzilla. Number three, The Avengers. Number four, an Alan Smith film, Burn Hollywood Burn. And number five, for Worst Picture nominations, Armageddon. Which of these five films, Daza, won Worst Picture?
On notoriety, I would guess Godzilla.
You would be incorrect.
Oh.
It would be, and I don't even know what this is, an Alan Smith film, Burn Hollywood Burn? I'm pulling up the Wikipedia entry.
Right, yeah, now. If I remember, this is kind of like a... It's kind of like a spoof on the American studio system. Mm. And it's a spoof on the Alan Smithy. Because if you don't know, Alan Smithy is basically, if ever a director or a writer basically departs from a film, basically wants his name taken off a film, they basically give him the pseudonym of Alan Smithy. Because for years and years, you'll see Alan Smithy's name crop up. It's basically any time that sort of like someone has basically said, you know, I don't want to be associated with this piece of shit. So they just gave Alan, it's kind of like a running joke on Hollywood. And I know they did make a film which was basically meant to be something to do with Alan Smith. I've never seen it. But I think it's kind of like it's meant to be a satire on Hollywood. I think the plot's a bit like The Producers or something, where somebody makes a really, really bad film deliberately. I could be wrong on that, but I've heard about it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, it managed to rope it. They managed to convince Eric Idle to be in the movie, which it's a crying shame considering how talented he is. Let's see who else made their way into this film. Sylvester Stallone, Whoopi Goldberg, Jackie Chan. Let's see, the director by the name. Yeah, a big budget. Wait. They may not. I'm very quickly reading this, but yeah, that's pretty much the premise of the film. It's obviously a takeoff the Alan Smithy thing as far as when they're choosing to make a film and the actor wants their name off of it. Okay. I'm very quickly going to go off the rest of this list. Bruce Willis in Armageddon, Mercury Rising and The Siege for Worst Actor.
All three?
Yes. Well, we've seen that before, where they'll consider an actor for all their films respectively. I like that they use the term respectively when they're panning them and they're ripping on how terrible of an actor they are. Worst actress is interesting. All five of these Spice Girls.
Yeah. Yeah. That must be, yeah.
Let's see. Worst on-screen couple, Leonardo DiCaprio as himself as the twins in The Man, The Iron Mask. That's an interesting pick. A three-way tie for worst remake or sequel. Avengers, Godzilla, and Psycho. I did not know this was the year that they remade Psycho.
That's a really pointless film as well, the Psycho one, because they basically just do every single shot, every single scene shot for shot. Mm-hmm. It's the epitome of a remake that they're basically just sort of like, it's basically just restaging it. It's been the most bizarre.
I'm looking at notables. Worst new star. I find this odd enough. Jerry Springer in Ringmaster. Ooh, here's another. Obviously, Jerry Springer tied for the award, but also notable Carrot Top and Chairman of the Board.
God.
Have you heard the Norm MacDonald when he was on the Conan O'Brien show with Carrot Top? It was awesome.
No.
Because Carrot Top was there to promote his film, but he was there and he was sort of picking on Norm MacDonald. And just Norm MacDonald just goes to town on this guy. He's all, your name of the film is Chairman of the Board. Can I bet how board is spelled? B-O-R-E-D.
You know, Carrot Top's, I've been going to Vegas for about 6 years now. Carrot Top's been there the entire time, and that is the one show I've never felt inclined to go see. well, that and the Donnie and Marie experience. I've never felt the need to go see that one either. But yeah, I've never been.
You probably never will.
No. And it'll probably be there next year.
Ooh, there's a new, I don't know if it's a new award, but worst movie trends of the year. And, let's see.
Asteroids.
Or the THX, the audience is now deafening. I like that little bit that they do. The Yukero, tacky tie-ins for Godzilla. What else? That's about it. I mean, I like this award. It's a wacky award that they added to the list, but, I did not know there was a Barney film. I'm looking at Worst Original Song. The Barney Song, apparently, for Worst Original Song.
Oh, God, can you imagine? I mean, to take your kids to see that. I mean, Barney is... I've seen Barney. I actually, being the great friend that I am for my godson, I basically bought him some Barney DVDs. You know, just to drive his parents nuts. I do things like that. But yeah, I actually had to watch a little bit of it, and oh God, can't imagine having to sit through a film of it. Be it like sort of having to sit through The Chipmunks.
Ooh, this is not fair. I don't want to miss a thing from Armageddon as worst original song. I'm sure
that's complete. Oh, bullshit.
I think that is bullshit. I think it may have been just the backlash to it, because I remember growing up in that era. And yeah, if you flipped on the radio, there was no avoiding that song. But that's not really fair. That's a perfectly fine song. In fact, now that I think about it, I think that's going to play us out this week. That's a great song. I don't care what you say about the film. It's a terrible film, but that's a great song. That's the one shining.
Oh yeah,
that's the one takeaway from the film that's at least somewhat worthwhile. All right, we got the films out of the way. As long as we're talking films, Dazza, what have you been watching as of late?
The last film that I saw I went to a cinema once last week, and it was to see Arrival, which was absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, that's the thing. I went to the cinema this week as well, and I was going to watch Doctor Strange, but I kind of had my reservations about the film. So a buddy of mine says, let's watch Arrival, and I had not seen anything about it, not heard anything about it. So I was on the fence as far as between this and Doctor Strange. Dazza, did I make the wrong decision?
No, not at all. I mean, I would still go see Doctor Strange, but Arrival, I So did you say you'd seen Arrival?
No, I saw Doctor Strange, but I was on the fence. Okay. I was like, should I watch Arrival or should I watch Doctor Strange? And I wanted to know if I made the decision or not.
I misunderstood. I mean, basically, you didn't make a wrong decision as such. Basically, if you're, because Doctor Strange is basically our sort of film, it's, you know, but I would definitely go back and see Arrival if you can, because it was absolutely astounding. It's a film you've got to be basically sort of very much prepared and in the mood for, because it's not like a spectacular film. It's basically about aliens coming to Earth and basically the landing key places around the world, and it's following a mathematician and a linguistic who are basically trying to communicate with the aliens, mm-hmm. and basically find out the intentions and stuff. And there's certain things that which are happening in other places where basically other countries are actually preparing for war and stuff. And it's all about sort of like trying to understand someone and the miscommunication that can sort of lead to tragedy and stuff. There's times when you're watching it and some scenes can basically seem a bit slow, but the story itself is so gripping that you sort of overlook that. And it's just an amazing, it's one of these films that afterwards I came out on such a high, not because it's like a feel good film by any means, but it just was so well done as a piece of cinema. It was absolutely, you know, breathtaking. It's just one of those films that just works so massively well. And it reminds me a little bit of Interstellar. The only difference being that with Interstellar, I came away from that film thinking that it was kind of like a ripoff, and that it was sort of like it built up, and then the payoff that you got was kind of like just sort of really weird and out there, and you just sort of, you know, you felt kind of sort of ripped off. In Arrival, everything basically paid off really, really well. You know, there were sort of twists in it that worked. When you actually sort of, you know, step back and look at the whole film as a whole, it was just sort of, it's just an amazing, you know, piece of cinema. And just absolutely, you know, compelling, exciting, but also really intelligent and down to earth. It's got like a Close Encounters type sort of, backstory to it with the sort of, you know, the communication and everything, but just an amazing piece of work. Just sort of but very subtle. You have to be quite patient with it and in the mood. But I personally think, and everyone I've sort of know who's seen this has said, I think this is like, you know, one of the best films of the year. And I would hope, and because there's a lot of politics in this sort of thing, I would hope that there'd basically be, an Oscar nomination. You know, if not for best film, and basically sort of for best actress in this, it's just a great film. I really recommend it.
Okay. Anything else?
I've not really seen any. I've been a bit busy this week, so I've not had a chance to go. But I'm going to the cinema tomorrow to see a couple of films, so I'll have something more for you next week.
Oh, there you go. All right. Have you read anything as of late? I know you tend to read anywhere between novels and comic books, so I'm just curious to see what you read this week.
The only comic book of any note, I'm actually reading a book which I'm sort of working through, and it's a crime book called 6-4. It's actually a Japanese novel. It's actually really weird for a crime book because so much of it is basically... It's one of those books when you read the back, it sounds like it's all about a police officer whose daughter's gone missing, and it all basically throws back to this case about 18 years ago when another girl went missing and was basically murdered. But when you actually read the book, it's actually all about police politics, and it's very strange. It's quite. When it's good, it's really compelling, but there's a lot to do with red tape and bureaucracy in there, you know. So there's certain bits of it when you sort of read them, it just kind of sort of drag you down a little bit. And there's also, because the Japanese, you've got to basically understand, it does this really well, but you the first sort of like 50 pages or so is basically sort of getting you to know how Japanese media relations with the with the police actually works, which is fine, but it's basically it's important for the story as a whole. But it does basically mean that at certain points it can sort of drag a little bit. But it's a really good book. But it's just not the most dramatic read I've read, put it that way. The one comic that I've sort of read of any note this week is I wanted to give a comic I've really been looking forward to is Mother Panic. Which is part of the DC Young Animals list. And I was really intrigued by this because this DC Young Animals imprint, it's almost like a Vertigo type imprint where they're basically sort of, giving sort of like, new talent a go and basically sort of trying to do something a little bit different and alternative. But this one, as with that remit, it was also set in Gotham City with Batman and everything. So I was actually quite interested to see what I was going to do. And I have to say, I was really disappointed with it.
Yeah, I was too. Obviously, I wouldn't say it was a complete waste of time because I do like the character, but at the same time, considering most of the Young Animal books have been pretty good. In fact, did you read this week's Doom Patrol? This week's Doom Patrol was spectacular.
I've read issue two. I've read issue. Are you on issue three?
I'm on issue three. Yes, I'm doing my comic book show.
I've read
Alex
issues one
tomorrow.
And two, so I've not got issue three yet.
Yeah, here's the thing though. How familiar are you with Grant Morrison's work?
I've read quite a few of his other stuff from time to time. Yeah, so I'm not like a connoisseur of Grant Morrison, but I've read sort of I've read his X-Men run and stuff. So I'm sort of I am like familiar with him.
Well,
and I read Zenith for 2000 AD, which was one of my favourite British superhero comics that was ever done.
Well, the reason why I bring this up, because it relies heavily on you having read Flex Metallo, as well as maybe some of his Doom Patrol.
Right.
Because there are things, especially the second half of the book, where it's just heavily depends on having you read that material. Obviously, you know Gerard Way is a big fan of Grant Morrison. That's probably one of the things that inspired him to get into comic books. It's one of the reasons why he's writing Doom Patrol, because he was just influenced by Grant Morrison's take on the Doom Patrol, so it would make sense, but it's a little cringy. I mean, it's a really good book, and I'm absolutely going to put it over, but it's a little cringy in the sense that it's like, okay, we get it. You're a really big fan of Grant Morrison, but it almost comes off as, I guess, to a degree, as fan fiction or as as a tribute, and it's like, oh, this is a little like you'd expect a fan to do something like this, and obviously that's what he is, but you wouldn't expect to be reading this in the pages of an actual comic book produced by DC. And then, it sounds like I'm burying the book, but I really liked it. But at the same time, it's like, oh, it's like, we know you like Grant Morrison a lot, but it's like, can you not be a fan for like 5 seconds, maybe?
Yeah, just there's a bit of hero worship.
There we go. That's the term I was looking for. And it's like,
yeah,
there's nothing wrong with paying tribute to a certain writer's run of a book. There's nothing wrong with picking up where they left off. But when it just comes off as hero worship, it's like, oh, okay. Who decided to publish this? But with that said, the direction he decides to go, it's really cool. I really like it. It's a little different than the Morrison stuff, but just this aspect of it. A little cringeworthy. Like I said, it is, in fact, hero worship. But like I said, I'm really going to recommend you go out of your way to pick that up as soon as possible. Because this, as someone who wasn't too keen on his Doom Patrol, I'm absolutely in love with it now. And I'm currently reading the Morrison stuff, so I lucked out because I'm like, okay, I could see the casual person, or obviously you mentioned the people. Actually, you haven't mentioned. I've heard a friend of mine mention that a lot of non-comic book readers are picking up these series because of Gerard Way. I can't imagine them reading this and making heads or tails of it because a lot of stuff is referential to other runs. But is that all you've been reading it, the Mother Panic book?
Yeah, I mean, the Mother Panic, just to sort of, go back to it, I was just expecting something a little different, but set in the DC universe and sort of in Gotham and everything. And it just came across, I mean, it was well done for what it was, but it just came across as another vigilante in Gotham. And I don't know if it's going to be like a slow build where you can sort of like, sort of learn more about the character and everything. But it just seemed to be like a more wide, it was almost like taking a Bruce Wayne thing and just taking it into like a, well, this one's a woman and she's sort of got a drug history and everything. And there was a little bit of intrigue, you know, because I really like the villain. And I like this. I'm also sort of intrigued about what this throne was that was basically, you know, what we, you know, that was sort of, that was basically so shocking and stuff. But generally speaking, I came out of it and I thought for the first issue, it really didn't grab me. And also one of the things that I kind of was like, I know it's in Gotham and everything, but it's like, why does Batman have to appear in the first issue? It's like, obviously the paths are going to cross, but wouldn't it be, I'd like to sort of get like, you know, the character established first and then sort of, whereas he, you know, you almost said like, you know, Batman appears straight, you know, pretty much halfway through the book. So obviously he's going to be involved in the first comic, first storyline. So I was just generally, disappointed with this. And it's one that I've been really looking forward to.
Yeah. It's the one of the Young Animals imprint that I wouldn't say it was a disappointment, but it's the weakest of the bunch.
Yeah, for an imprint which is basically trying to do things different and really really wild, you know, a lot of it came across to me as basically just, you know, a more edgier Gotham Vigilante book.
Yeah, and you were kind of hoping more for this imprint, obviously. I thought it was supposed to be set in its own continuity, but with Batman's inclusion, I wonder just really where does it take place in the DC continuity? Because really, when you include Batman, it's like, okay, well, then you're acknowledging all the stuff is happening in the proper DC continuity. So I'm just curious where its places, all things considered.
Yeah. But that is pretty much the only sort of one I've actually read. But I have actually got a few graphic novels of some different stuff. I won't say what they are, but I'll basically have going to sample for next week, which are basically one's a recent controversial comic, and an old British classic.
Oh, I think I know. So, I won't spoil it for our listeners, but I think I know what it is.
Yeah. And like I said, the other one's an old British classic, which I've basically never got around to reading, but I've sort of, I'm going to give it a go to.
Okay. That's I'm very much looking forward. I already know what it is, and we'll talk about it off air, but I want to leave that to tease to the listeners to give them a reason to listen to next week's show. All right. Daz, have you been working on any articles that we know of? Obviously, you talked about you've been busy as of late, so I'm curious if you've had any time to write any articles on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, basically, one of the reasons why I was sort of a bit busy this weekend is fitting around work. I was basically doing my traditional Invicta preview piece.
Ooh, nice.
Which, if it's not up already, should be basically hitting any time. It's I always do the Invicta previews and most of the time I do a recap as well. Basically, because it's just a promotion I really, really believe in. I really sort of, you know, I'm invested in. Following and by writing these articles, I feel even more invested because I sort of it prompts me to basically look into the background of the fighters involved, and also sort of like, you know, looking, you know, I'm basically the amount of when I do this is probably the most work that I put into anything on Half Guarded is the Invicta previews. You know, by basically sort of reading through their interviews, their past stories, but also the amount of sort of like really bad shaky footage fights I've watched on YouTube, you know, because I basically want to sort of like, you know, get a feel for the, you know, especially for the ones who are just starting their professional careers, but have been fighting on the amateur ranks for so long. I always want to sort of do justice and just sort of take a look, you know, at them and sort of give some sort of, you know, mention and talk about. So that's up there now. Really interesting card next week. Tonya Evinger's in the main event, who's basically on a, if she wins this, she's on a 10-match winning streak. She's sort of like, you know, one of the sort of like really underappreciated stars of MMA. We've got a co-main event, a title fight as well. We've got Angela Hill versus Kaleen Medeiros, which that fight's going to be insane. You know, basically the two women who basically look like, and I actually mentioned this in the article, look like they're from a Mad Max movie. You know, with mohawks, you know, really colourful outfits. Yeah. And both of them actually sort of like, you know, all stand up and everything. So this could be a really cracking fight. Amber Brown's on there, who was one of my favourites. Jessica Rose Clark, who has a really inspiring backstory. She's basically had a really difficult childhood, shall we say, and also has had a let's just say she has had a bit of a she had a relationship with an absolute twat, basically, who basically pretty much mistreated her and is a really pretty nasty piece of work. And so hopefully she's basically training with Roxanne Mondefairy these days. So she's in more positive surroundings, hopefully. So, so yeah, but you know, again, I always love these Invicta cards, and it's the one, if it was ever one, only one thing I ended up doing for Half Guarded, it would be the Invicta cards. Cause I get a real buzz out of it. And so, and some of the fighters who are basically, who are featuring there are basically sort of, you know, reached out and said how much they like the articles, which is always sort of nice. So yeah. So this is the this is kind of a but one thing that I really take pride in.
Yeah, I can confirm as of right now, Monday afternoon, obviously Monday night for you, the articles are on halfguarded.com right now as we speak.
Oh, okay, okay.
Is the featured article? I don't know if it'll stay there by the time this podcast comes out, but I can confirm right now it is in fact the featured article.
Okay, cool.
All right. I think that's going to do it, unless there's anything you want to talk about before we wrap this thing up, Daz.
No, not really. Just saying that the moon is not as big as I hoped it would be. I was expecting, we'll talk about this like super moon tonight. I was expecting something like the size of the Death Star, but I'd look out and it'd just be this big, massive monolith. And it's not, it's just a little bit bigger than it normally is.
Did you do the line?
But it's still the moon, so it's still awesome.
Did you do the line, that's no moon, that's a battleship.
That's a space station.
Oh, space station.
Oh, if you're going to quote Star Wars to me, yeah, you've got to
yeah,
get the quote.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Okay. You got me, Daz. Are you happy?
Yeah.
All right, I think that's going to do it for this week's show. So from all of us at HalfGuarded.com, thanks for checking out this week's show. And as always, catch you guys next week. Adios.
Stay awake just to hear you breathing. Watch you smile while you